Hello, and welcome to this third-to-last Tech Weekly for 2008. I'm Alex Kratosky, and today we're coming to you direct from lovely London, a city wallowing in the onslaught of winter. Gosh, the nights are fair drawing in, aren't they? Joining me to wish springtime back faster than you can say seasonal affective disorder are Padista's Jemima Kish and Charles Arthur. Welcome to you both.
Hola.
How do you beat the winter blues?
Food, usually. Food.
Yeah, log fire.
Oh, you got a log fire?
That sounds cozy.
I could try that in my flat, but I don't think it would last very long.
I have a friend who did that. It wasn't a good idea.
Actually, a tramp used to live in our house 20 years ago when it was derelict, and they did burn the whole top floor down and had to rebuild it. I don't know why I told you that.
Don't try this at home, kids. Moving on. On today's show, we're tackling internet censorship, debating why and how the Internet Watch Foundation were able to ban pages from Wikipedia thanks to the content of a 32-year-old album cover. And on the flip side, we're looking at the output of the second social innovation camp, the event where geeks gather to change the world with the web. It's the highs and the lows of the human condition here on Tech Weekly. Grab your full spectrum light, crank up the volume, and get ready to bask in our glow. Last Friday, the Internet Watch Foundation implemented a ban on a Wikipedia entry depicting the cover art on the 1976 Scorpions album Virgin Killer. Now, the image, which I have to say, even in the late 1970s, courted controversy by depicting a naked underage girl in quite a provocative pose, I have to say, it was included alongside the album details on Wikipedia. Now, the watchdog, whose sensors went into overdrive, of course, blocked six British ISPs from accessing it, deeming it too offensive for public access. Now, understandably, the image and the IWF's decision to retroactively remove it has rippled through the web. And at the time that we're recording this, it is still banned. However, I'm aware that the IWF is currently discussing these things. So perhaps by tomorrow, when the podcast is released, things will be different. However, here to discuss the issues as they stand and the implications further on down the line is computing and security expert Dr. Richard Clayton from Cambridge University. Welcome, Richard, and thank you very much for joining us.
Good afternoon.
Now, can you tell me, can you beef out the story a little bit, please?
Well, the story is that the image, which is extremely tasteless, as you say, is one of these images that sits on the boundary between what is quite clearly completely unacceptable material and the sort of material that many people might not consider to be actually illegal and indecent. And context is everything, so viewing it all by itself might be very different from viewing it in the context of the Wikipedia webpage.
This whole situation reminds me so much of I don't know if you're familiar with the Spinal Tap movie, but there's a classic bit of it where I'm sure that it was based upon this particular image. The band try and recreate some kind of horrendously offensive imagery. The image has been on the Wikipedia entry for a while, and as far as I'm aware, the IWF hasn't got involved in British Wikipedia access in the past. Is that correct?
The image has certainly been there for some time because there was a big row about it back in May where somebody reported it to the FBI. The FBI looked into it and decided that this wasn't illegal, but there was a big row then amongst all the people on Wikipedia as to whether or not it was appropriate to include the image, and they considered the matter in quite a lot of depth at that time and decided that that from the point of view of their rules as operating their encyclopedia, then keeping the image was a proper thing to do. Now, the IWF only actually reacts to reports. They don't go around scouring the net looking for images. They operate a hotline. They were told about this image only last Thursday, as I understand it. They looked at it, probably in isolation, and they concluded that, in their opinion, it was illegal under UK law. And in their opinion, a jury would find it indecent, and therefore they listed it.
The IWF's workings have been sort of hard to perceive before, haven't they? You've done some work into trying to figure out how it is that URLs get put into BT's clean feed system, which is effectively the system that actually implements this blacklist, haven't you? Can you just explain for us why it would be that clean feed blocks the page as well as the image?
Well, as I understand it, the IWF have actually listed two URLs, one of which is the URL of the page, which includes the image, and they've also listed the image itself on a separate page where there's a discussion about the image and whether or not it's proper to have the image because it might be in somebody else's intellectual property. The Page has been messed around with a certain amount over the weekend with people editing it, which makes it very difficult to actually pick apart what the page looked like when and exactly when the IWF looked at it.
What does this? The content is available elsewhere on the web, ultimately.
The content is available on the Amazon.com website, or at least it was over the weekend. They seem to have changed it, probably as a result of the fuss. It wasn't available on the Amazon Co. UK website because the album you'd buy in the UK today, for that album, you'd get the alternative cover. Though, interestingly, if you bought one of the box sets for them, then you would get the old cover. and so you can go down the high street and buy it. If you go to Google Images, you can find 50 or 60 different copies scattered around the web. Now, of course, that research has been done since the fuss blew up, but the IWF operates a hotline, so it actually goes and checks images which people tell it about. And essentially, its processes are not set up for an image which is quasi-legal, which is very widely distributed, which a lot of people up and down the country may have on in their record collections.
The whole thing seems horribly inconsistent. I mean, there must be, a huge amount of sites, not just with this picture, but things like Charles and I were saying earlier, the Blind Faith album cover, which is very similar, of a girl holding a big kind of phallic plane from, I think, the 70s as well.
There's a Van Halen one. There's a long list of these. Well, we always get these sort of fusses. If you look, you may recall stories about some of Elton John's pictures being seized from an art gallery up in Newcastle upon Tyne. The police have raided East End art galleries of pictures of children peeing in the snow, that sort of thing. We often get this sort of thing at the boundary between what is indecent and what is in fact lawful. But the procedure appears to be that the authorities act first, doubtless to protect us all, and then there's a fuss, the CPS decides not to prosecute, and they sheepishly return the pictures.
But it's very much a knee-jerk reaction, isn't it? Because it's so quick to respond, they can, so it's perhaps not as thought out as it could be.
Well, yes, but equally, if these had been images of babies being raped then, and the site wasn't removed immediately, then lots of other people would be jumping up and down and saying, this is terrible, why is it taking so long to act on what is clearly illegal?
Is the IWF doing an effective job? I mean, I was looking at the numbers. 35,000 complaints a year, which works out to 700 a week, which works out to 140 per day, which they say they have four analysts looking at them, is an average of 35 each per working day. Over a seven-hour day, that's about five an hour. It doesn't sound like they're actually doing very much. Is it that it's very hard to do, or that they just do it very slowly?
They're not just looking at the images, but they're also acting essentially as an outpost of the police, in that they're putting together packages of information about the website where they find the illegal material. So it won't take them very long to deal with something which is merely objectionable, but they consider to be somebody who is over 18 and therefore a perfectly legal image, and it's just pornographic and people may be upset about it. However, when it is illegal material, they're putting together packs of information and then shipping off reports to the police and abroad.
Well, many thanks to you, Dr. Clayton, and do keep an eye out for more information on this issue at guardian.co.uk/technology. And now here's Jemima with more of the latest.
The government is launching a £1 billion emergency venture capital fund to help technology startups. Conceived by the National Endowment for Science, Technology and the Arts, the fund will draw cash from the private sector, mainstream business and universities in an effort to help startups through the downturn. The nation's web shoppers hit the keyboards on Mega Monday this week, the busiest online shopping day of the year. Online sales are expected to rise to 15% of all retail spending this year, with the Christmas period alone accounting for £13.2 billion. Yahoo is due to confirm up to 2,000 redundancies this week, as announced by outgoing chief executive Jerry Yang in late October. Yang is sticking around in the role for some time, but is also expected to reveal his successor soon. And the Nintendo Wii took top spot in eBay's list of top gadget and tech toys of 2008. The Wii sold nearly 2.1 million units and related products on eBay, followed by Xbox 360 with 1.3 million and the Sony PSP some way behind at 350,000.
So the story with the Wii, that the Wii is the top seller on eBay, I think is a little bit
misguided. Well, not misguided, but it just...
That's what the people say, Alex.
Misrepresented.
What the people say.
Well, I think there's a lot of hope with the Wii, that the Wii is going to be the one that's going to get the games industry through this recession. And we've written in the paper a lot about how is the games industry recession-proof. People are pointing at the Wii because they say that it's the Wii that has created this massive bubble of everybody buying, you know, all the casual gamers, people who wouldn't traditionally buy a console in the past. But these aren't the people who are necessarily going to buy the games. They're not the hardcore
gamers.
But
that sort of makes it sound like it's a bad thing that it's had this spike in people going and buying users. Surely that it's not a bad thing for the industry that this whole new sector of people's been exposed to gaming, is it?
It's not a bad thing, no, but I think that that relying upon the Wii as this mighty savior of the games industry is not a very clever thing to do, because ultimately those people they're not going to buy another game, are they? They're going to buy dinner, they're going to go out to the movies, they're going to go to a gig, because the gaming isn't their primary entertainment.
The fools. But I mean, surely, I mean, if you expand the market, you know, the number of people who might buy a game, then if you've expanded it by 100-fold, you know, just to take a number, and you know, 2 out of that 100 buy an extra game, then if you can compare to what it was, you've got 2 games sold, where when you had the market that was just one person and they only bought 1 game. You've doubled your market.
Surely it doesn't take away from the hardcore gamers that are always going to buy games anyway. It is only an extra audience, isn't
but
it?
At the same time, on top of that layer is this idea that it's being sold from eBay. So effectively, the pool isn't necessarily bigger. It's not like it's coming directly from Nintendo, the publisher, or the console holder.
Possibly, I suspect a lot of these are eBay shops, you know, people, because after all, you know, the big thing with eBay this year has been it moving from being an auction site where people are trying to hit the button at the last second to one where actually they're just going, eBay, buy it now. Buy it now.
We all just go to Etsy now anyway.
Well, speaking of startups, because Etsy is a startup. Nesta's funding.
$1 billion.
Like a significant amount of funding.
It does, although read the small print and it's spread across nanotech, biotech, IT, you know, and it's $1 billion, which, you know, is better than nothing, but it's going to be spread very thinly.
Take it across 250 companies and it's £4 million each.
And is this to private companies, or is this money also perhaps going to educational institutions? I know some of it's coming from universities, but
I think it is very much aimed at startups. Mm. Whether that would include startups that aren't private startups, very hard to know. You know, it's all in the small print.
It's all quite woolly as well. I think they only hammered it out on Thursday last week, so it's not even a week old yet.
And is this actually solving a problem that exists, or is this a problem that's amplified by a lot of the attention that people are saying recession?
I think it's anticipating a problem. I mean, it's quite well understood there aren't enough angel investors in the UK compared to, you know, the Valley. Most notably. But there had been quite a lot of interest from VC guys. And as Charles pointed out earlier, 3i has just cut 15% of its staff, and there will probably be a lot more cautious activity from the VC sector. So this is trying to anticipate that, I think. I mean, it's certainly welcome, but it's going to be bloody tough. It's going to be bloody tough.
If it's coming to try to fund companies in biotech, especially, that really eats up money.
Just think, $1
billion. $1 billion.
Anyway, you can read up on these stories on guardian.co.uk, but this last story is particularly relevant to what we're going to be talking about next. So what do you get when you put a bunch of idealist web designers and programmers into a room for a weekend? Well, you get a bunch of idealistic web design ideas aimed at making the real world a better place. Jemima, you went to the second social innovation camp. It was in London last weekend.
Bethnal Green.
Bethnal, what happened?
It was very interesting. 7 teams. Quite highfalutin ideas, some of them. One on carbon change, for example. They wanted to get people to club together so they could get discounts on things like solar panels. All great ideas. Characteristically quite ambitious, I think a bit too ambitious for things they could do in a weekend. And also you sort of got the impression they've been doing the projects for a long time, and this was just one bus stop en route to somewhere more grand, and they didn't really exploit the resources they had there, like mentors and developers and stuff. On the other hand, great for the developers to have, you know, a proper objective and some social good, not just building tech for the sake of it. So I started by talking to Dominic Campbell, who explained what his team with Accessity is trying to do.
I'm leading the idea Accessity, as in access and city. And the idea essentially is based around how can we bring people together to make London more accessible. So whether people have mobility issues, whether they are a parent with a pram, what is it about London that you find difficult? And so what we want to do is build a platform so that users of London transport or accessible toilets or shops or other businesses can actually record their experience of moving around London. And hopefully we will actually then be able to gather it in a way that for people like Transport for London, they will have a place where they can understand what their customers are saying and actually try and prioritise some of their work based on need and what people want rather than just what engineers think is the most important thing.
We're right at the beginning of the hack. What are the sort of big challenges that you think you're going to have to get through in the next 24 hours or so?
I guess the main thing for us was just about prioritisation. You can have anything you want. I think the functionality long list that we got to could probably cover a startup for 3 years. Hopefully we can keep it limited and just demonstrate its potential.
I'm Paul Miller and I'm CEO of School of Everything. That's my day job. And I was one of the founders of Social Innovation Camp.
So explain the basic idea. I mean, why is this an important concept? And I suppose why do it now as well?
For me, the idea came from our experience with School of Everything. I just realised how fragile ideas are before you get to something real. So you've got this idea that could change the world, but it's just an idea on the back of an envelope. And then you need to get it to the point where it's real enough so as you can show it to people outside of your, you know, that tiny group of people who came up with the idea in the first place. And, you know, one of the ways that we did that with School of Everything was we'd go away for like a couple of days and we just code and we just talk and we just like work on the strategy. And having that intensity was really important to us. We've gone through this age of basically the internet just being frivolity and iPhone apps where you sort of pour a pint of beer into your mouth or whatever it might be. And it's, you know, why? You know, there's so many better things that the coders could spend their time on. And I feel like we've kind of untapped something actually in London. You know, when we first sort of started this, and suddenly we're getting like hundreds and hundreds of people saying, yeah, I want to come along. I want to give my really expensive time for free. I think it is changing as well. It's sort of, you know, downturn and the fact that the VC market has just kind of dried up. Yeah, these are projects that matter. They're projects that could last a lot longer, that could be much more sustainable than, you know, iPhone apps.
So Matt Bidolf from Doppler, there were some really great ideas in there. What was your overall impression of the quality of presentations and you know, how those projects came across?
Some teams maybe spent too much time defining the problem and saying what they would like to happen if a perfect solution existed. And then there were some teams who obviously went straight to the technology and said, well, we made a website and we hope there'll be some effect for it. And I think the best ones was the people sort of met in the middle and said, well, we're not going to build anything in a weekend that's going to solve a big problem. So here's a prototype that demonstrates how technology can address this problem without trying to solve the whole thing in one go.
I'm Amer Haq. I'm the director of the Havas Media Lab.
Okay, so you're one of the judges here today. Okay. So let us know who won and why the judges thought they deserved it.
So the winner this time around was Good Gym, and the judges thought that Good Gym could be quite a disruptive idea because, you know, we all work out, we all exercise, we all spend a lot of money and a lot of time doing it, but frankly, we do it kind of in isolation or maybe we do it with a couple of buddies and it doesn't have a social benefit. It's a very easy way to turn an existing set of activities to do some good, almost costlessly. So we thought it was a cool idea. It could be turned around in a relatively short amount of time. And we all really liked it.
My name's Ivo.
Okay, so you were presenting Good Gym to everyone. What's going to happen with Good Gym?
Well, I think there's been a lot of interest in it. And I think just that we have been able to sign up 20 volunteers, I think there is willingness towards it. People accept it as a very simple idea that might work. And so I hope we can keep it going, really.
They were all great ideas, but some of them were perhaps a little too ambitious.
Yeah, you know, a lot of the other ideas were really good. One of my favorites was useful visitors, where, you know, people who are visiting different, I guess, third world countries can go and volunteer with different aid agencies or even at local small businesses or schools or whatever. I thought that was a cool idea, but, you know, to build something that's global in scope, I think is going to take a lot of commitment, a lot of resources, and it needs to be maybe fleshed out more fully than we have time for 2 days at a camp like this. So Good Gym, which was kind of focused on London or kind of maybe even European metro areas, is a bit closer to reality.
What was it that got you inspired to get involved in Social Innovation Camp? I mean, is it really important that these ideas have a sort of practical manifestation?
Yeah. We're in the middle of a huge economic crisis, and I think that, not to be too abstract about it, but I think that, you know, the way that we think about the stuff that we do has to change. And, you know, for me, that means that business itself is going to think a lot more about social benefits. And especially, you know, on the marketing side of things, we are going to think a lot more about how do we help corporations do a lot more good than they have been doing. So what's interesting to me about this is we've got a bunch of people who are really young and they're really excited and they really want to see things and do things in a new way. And to me, that is how we're going to get out of this mess, not through bailouts and bankers and any of this stuff. We're going to have to change the way that we fundamentally do things. And it's going to be through new kinds of, you know, whether we call them social businesses or social enterprises, but it's going to be through new ways of doing, of interacting with each other. Things like Good Gym.
That was Umair Haque, and he was at Social Innovation Camp. So Jemima, were there any ideas that you heard about that didn't, say, get the accolades that you thought really should have been focused on a little bit more?
Well, actually, one of the guys we spoke to there, this was Go Postal. It's kind of an update of the mail preferencing service. It was one of the two ideas, along with Good Gym, that was just very simple and very achievable. And also one that worked particularly on the web, unlike some of the others where you felt the website was sort of incidental, really. You basically say, this company, fill in box, has been spamming me, my name, here's my email address. And that's it. And with a kind of My Society style, they look after the whole of the rest of the thing. They've got the addresses of the company. They send them a form letter which says very, very politely, I'd be very grateful if you could remove my name and address from your mailing list. And this is about real printed stuff, you know. And then they tied it into things like the Amy carbon calculator. So you could see by, you know, cancelling that catalogue you used to get once every 6 months, how much carbon would be saved. Just very simple idea and beautifully executed in as far as it got that weekend.
So what sounds really interesting is that it was actually about using these technologies to, on a larger social scale, to make the world a better place.
Well, it was. I think also a lot of the people that have the ideas aren't very technical. And so what they had at their disposal for that weekend was some brilliant developers and also business development people and user interface specialists. So some really fascinating resources.
Is there actually money in these enterprises and are they viable?
Well, they were all encouraged in their final 10-minute presentation at the end of Sunday, at the end of the weekend, to explain how their business would be sustainable and how it would pay for itself. And interestingly, I think most of them avoided saying, oh, it would be advertising and we'd wait for the scale of audience, because nobody wants to do that in this climate. It was all maybe corporate sponsorship or maybe a freemium model. So they were all thinking about that. Whether it will happen in practice, I don't know.
Well, thanks, Jemima. And if you're intrigued by any of these ideas and have a pot of cash to invest, or even if you just want some inspiration, head to blogs.guardian.co.uk/digitalcontent for details. And speaking of blogs, we're doing some nice segues this week, I have to say. What's been happening in Guardian blogland this week? Charles, we haven't heard from you in several minutes.
I actually enjoyed the comments which appeared under Richard Branson saying that Virgin Galactic, which is going to be his very short hop into space, or at least the sort of upper atmosphere, it's going to be fantastic. It's coming any day now for anyone who happens to have $200,000 or however much it is, which got a rather rapid response from Macca, who said, never mind Virgin Galactic, any chance to get my frickin' Virgin broadband working?
Completely name-dropping, but I accidentally sat in steerage next to the drummer out of We Are Scientists the other day when I was coming back from the States.
I know. Name-dropper. Was that in first class, Alex?
No, oh good Lord, no. I was way back next to the loos.
With the rest of the band in the first class, sorry.
Probably. Well, I said to him, well, why aren't you in first class? And he said, well, because everybody under the Virgin umbrella doesn't actually talk to one another. So even though he's signed to a Virgin subsidiary.
Oh, yeah, they're all owned by different companies.
Yeah, he can't actually get
the
perks of traveling. So, you know, he wouldn't be able to deal with the rail card or the galactic,
ooh,
whatever.
Absolutely
that was my name dropping for the year. Apologies. I just had to say that. Over on the games blog, moving quickly on, and speaking about music still, Keith brought up this fantastic article in the NME, which basically slated and proceeded to rip apart anybody who plays Guitar Hero on any of the consoles, on the Xbox, for example. And he quoted, or rather the article quoted several people, several high-profile artists, explaining why they think that people who play the games are losers as opposed to people who pick up actual guitars. For example, Nickelback said about Guitar Hero, "I feel like there's not enough rock bands out there, so kids start rock bands, set down the Guitar Hero, learn how to play an actual guitar, and start a band." But the backlash, as you can imagine, was immense from the gamers. Yes. Cagoule was quite funny because literally this NME article, just it was bile. It was absolute bile against the games industry. And he says this would be entirely unrelated to the series of NME tours going on in the UK that are brought to us in association with Guitar Hero. Oops. And Cheddar Frenzy was actually quite funny. And he says, "I'm actually quite surprised that Nickelback have come out against it. Maybe nobody asked them to be involved and now they're sulking."
Yay. I'm so, jealous that you've got a commenter called Cheddar Frenzy.
He's a regular as well. Genius.
Though I have to say,
we like a bit of cheese.
I mean, I did ask the whole, you know, guitars, Guitar Hero question back on Twitter a few weeks ago, and got sent pretty briskly to a web page which goes into the details and says, you know, it's sort of like saying, "Hey, you kids, stop playing Mario Kart, go and be a Formula One driver."
Jemima, what's happening on digital content?
No, I want to talk about that. Moving swiftly on, yeah, redundancies. That was it. It's not as exciting as Guitar Hero, sorry. Carsonified, the company behind Future of Web Apps and other things, had to make three people redundant at the end of last week. But the contrast between how the founder of that company handled it and how, you know, the very old-school media companies handle it is quite sharp, I think. Ryan Carson went on to the Carsonified blog earlier this week and said he named the three people that he'd had to make redundant. This is after checking it with them. And he said, "They're great guys. I really didn't want to have to do it, but I had to do it for the business. Please give them work because they're amazing." Which is just a really interesting way of handling it, I thought. And he was also quite blunt about some money-saving tips that will help small businesses through the recession. And then we had a comment from there were a few sceptical people on Carsonified's own blog, and then one comment on ours from what a palaver, there you go. "Sorry to intrude on this loving amongst these bright young things. My old headmaster always used to say, 'This will hurt me more than it hurts you.' When I got sent to the headmaster's office, I didn't believe him either. Did these people get more than the minimum redundancy pay?" And how many voices was that? I don't know.
Who you're channeling there.
Yeah. Went from Alistair Sim through the Thora Heard. Yeah. But the thing is, on the thread, yes. Ryan Carson then comes back and says, "Yes, we paid them all more than the standard redundancy pay."
Exactly. Good on him. Can you imagine, you know, the head of... I better not name a media organisation, but, you know, a media organisation that's been sacking loads of people recently coming on and... You know, handing it like that, I don't think so.
Well, it is. It's a small, you know, relatively small.
I know. It's apples and pears, really, but
everybody knows
it. Up the stairs, yeah.
Well, you can read all about these and comment, if you'd like, on all the blogs, which is blogs.guardian.co.uk/technology/games/digital-content. Now, elsewhere in the Guardian Tech Weekly universe, Naheem's emailed in to find out if we have accessible transcripts of this show for people who are hearing impaired. We actually have had this comment before. The bottom line is no, but we are still looking for a good voice recognition software. Please do let us know on our Facebook page, via Twitter, on email, or via good old-fashioned letter, paper, treeware. Our details are on the Tech Weekly page at guardian.co.uk/audio/techweekly. Now, while you're writing those suggestions, do throw in a few ideas for what you'd like to hear us talk about when we're looking forward to 2009. We'd really like to know what you think is going to be the next big thing, so do let us know.
In this Thursday's tech section with The Guardian, we look at the Muslim Second Life, Muxlim, set up by an entrepreneur which aims to create a place where Muslims can find like-minded people, as Second Life itself has a tiny Muslim membership. This Saturday, the BBC will be shown an episode of Dad's Army which has been recoloured following an article in Guardian Tech about colourising Doctor Who. This led to an expert getting in touch, and we've got pictures of the difference, as well as the boss of the BBC's iPlayer on his plans for the future. and following an idea from a former SAS soldier, how USB sticks are now being used to store medical emergency details instead of clunky jewellery. This and more in the tech section with The Guardian on Thursday.
That's all for this week. Many thanks to our guests, Dr. Richard Clayton and the gang at Social Innovation Camp. Cheers as well to our podtastics, Jemima and Charles. Next week, we're looking at the future content providers. No, not the user-generated malarkey on YouTube, but the stuff actually coming from MSN, believe it or not. Until then, I'm Alex Kratosky. Thanks for listening.